Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the University of Wisconsin Parkside, support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, offering an online master's degree in health and wellness management. Learn advanced wellness program management skills and make a difference in a rewarding career in partnership with UW Extension. Details at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
April is National Poetry Month, and we have celebrated that in various ways on the morning show. I am really pleased that on today's program, just as the month of April is finishing out, we can look at some of the newest, most innovative poetry with Mark Elleveld, who is the editor of a really extraordinary book called The Spoken Word Revolution.
Hi, Greg.
How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for the compliment on the book already.
The book is really quite interesting. It's published by Sourcebooks Incorporated, headquartered in Naperville, Illinois. We should mention that Sourcebooks is the company responsible for some other really interesting volumes that we have talked about on the morning show, including books like We Interrupt This Broadcast or And the Crowd Goes Wild, a wonderful volume devoted to poetry called Poetry Speaks, which takes us back actually even to the last decade of the 19th century as we hear all kinds of great poems read by the poets who wrote them. But this volume takes us into a whole different landscape, and I'm so excited that we can talk about it over the next few minutes.
Yeah, fantastic.
Tell us, first of all, Mark Elleveld, how this particular work got put together. Whose idea was it?
It's a pretty interesting story, actually. I probably am the only phone-in editor in the history of bookmaking. Dominique, who is the owner of Sourcebooks and one of the editors for the book Poetry Speaks that you spoke of, she was on a radio station with Milt Rosenberg on GN, and they were talking about Poetry Speaks, and they were talking about how important it is to have poets read their own work, and that it brings something new to life for hearing it, that it's the way the author, the poet, intended it to be read, that kind of thing. There was another anthologist on, an editor of a book, and he had a contemporary Illinois poets, and he didn't include any of the people that are in the performance poetry or the slam poetry scene. So I called in and asked some questions about that. I was a little taken back and kind of like, you know, you guys are saying in 2003 that it's important to hear the poet read his work. Well, in Chicago specifically, in 1980s, that was said by a guy by the name of Mark Smith, and he was put down pretty strongly in the press for saying it. People used to say that it's just the poem on the page that matters. It doesn't matter how it's read. So over the course of poetry slams and Mark Smith and all this going on, he was fighting a battle that was being ignored. So Poetry Speaks is an important book because it says for the first time maybe that the poets reading their work is a very important thing. So, you know, it's kind of a big thing. So when I called in, Dominique actually responded right away and said, you know what, we're working on a book just like the one you're talking about. So I put together an email, and I kind of lied about a couple of things, said I was a scholar on some stuff, sent it in to her, and we made a meeting to come together and to start working on this project.
Very good.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your own background, personally.
Sure. I'm an English teacher by trade. I was brought into the poetry scene in Chicago in the early 90s. I used to work with poet Mark Smith, who, again, is the guy who started the slam. And at the time, in the early 90s, I can't stress this enough, that poetry slams and people coming out to read their poetry was really looked down upon by the academy, the universities, a lot of the press. They kind of separated the two altogether. So it's only through the last decade, really, that this renaissance of poetry aloud has really taken over. So in the early 90s, I was introduced to the scene by Mark. I was doing PR for him. And at the same time, I was getting my English degrees at the universities. So I kind of had my foot in both worlds, so to speak. I was extremely appreciative of what Mark Smith was doing, other poets like Patricia Smith were doing. And I knew it was just as good on page as it was being read aloud. So that was one of my hidden agendas with the book, was to show that a lot of this modern contemporary poetry is just as good as anything else going on. And I think that's reflective. The U.S. Poet Laureate, Billy Collins, wrote a fantastic intro essay for the book where he talks about the same thing, kind of, that it's time for poetry to be read again.
Hmm. One of the things that is said in the opening track of the CD by Mark Smith, he said, and I wish I'd made a note exactly of his wording, but he says something about how you are you're going to be taken down a different path than you might think when you hear about a poetry reading,
right?
Because of course we think of that as being a very sort of sedate affair. What are we talking about in this particular collection, in this whole body of work? In what way is this set apart from the more stereotypical poetry reading that we might imagine?
Sure. We had three bigger ideas going into this. Number one, we wanted to chart the history of contemporary poetry, meaning poetry that's alive right now. The Poetry Speaks book is a wonderful canon, but all the poets in there are dead. It's the kind of book that you read and look at, especially in high school and at the college level, the 100 and 200 level courses. It's all the familiar poets, Whitman, Tennyson's in there, E.E. Cummings, those types of people. And if you're in college, when you take a modern or contemporary poetry class, you usually end up stopping in the late 50s, maybe early 60s. If the instructor's more into the scene, you might even take you up to the 80s. But when you take contemporary stuff, you know, you don't get the living, breathing poets. So this book is about the living, breathing poets that are making poetry more popular and exist present day. And another goal was to kind of break down some of those walls that were being put up in the late 80s and the 90s, saying that, you know, if you're in poetry slam, you can't be in the academia. If you're in the academia, you can't be in performance, this sort of thing. This poetry slam and poetry, they go together now. It's very rare that you will find an institution of higher learning that it somehow doesn't interact with slam. And likewise, at a slam reading, you won't find an academic person.
We better explain this term slam poetry for people whose connection to poetry is more along the lines of, I think I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree. What is slam poetry all about?
Sure. In the early 80s, Mark Smith in Chicago was kind of walking the streets. And he got bored at poetry readings. He said there were usually about 15 people. There'd be a very academic person at the booth or at the reading spot with a lot of high metaphors, kind of very obscure writing. And he would sit there, not understand, but feel obligated to clap for him. And so he said, enough of this. He said, you know, if you've got an audience and you have a stage, you have to pay attention to the audience. So he started writing in a way that the audience could connect. Accessibility is what Billy Collins, U.S. Poet Laureate, calls it. So that was one goal, to access himself to the audience, to honor the audience for coming to see him. Number two was that he wanted, on the heels of performance art, he wanted to follow in that vein and create like a performance poetry, meaning that you'll have these performance poets who are standing on chairs. They move their body to specific lines of their poem to emphasize them. They change their tones when they read, that sort of thing. So by 1985, this performance poetry thing started taking off. Here in Chicago, at the Green Mill Lounge, which is an old Al Capone jazzy bar, Mark Smith was doing a three-hour weekly poetry show. And he filled up the first 2 hours. The first hour was a feature, someone that is out of state usually would come in and read. Second hour, he did this thing called the Chicago Poetry Ensemble, where he used to position poets, different poets, in the audience. So, like, a guy playing, like, he's a veteran from Vietnam would come in with a poem and start screaming, or a cabbie would come out. You know, it was a show. The last section of the show is called the slam, and that's when anybody can get up and read. And then you pick three people out of the audience, no matter what their background is. It could be a construction worker, cab driver, a secretary, or it could be a teacher, whatever. Just pick them anonymously, and you say, score this poem between 1 and 10. What do you think? And then so they score them, and the winner in the Green Mill in Chicago would get, like, Twinkies or some goofy thing. So the whole idea behind a slam is to make a show of this poetry reading. The competition part of the slam was actually done kind of as a hoax. Mark was on 60 Minutes a couple years ago, and Maury Schaefer's kind of grinning at him. He says, you know, if you give Lord Byron numbers, or would you give, you know, Shelley numbers, that's ridiculous. And Mark kind of smiled and says, absolutely ridiculous, isn't it? So it's kind of a joke, that the slam competition. It's a joke in that it's not about the competition. It's about getting people away from their televisions, outside of their houses, into a club that interacts with other people, and to see performances of poetry. That's kind of what a slam is. And now, you know, there's 110 of them in the country. There's a nationals that brings over 300 poets each year. We're on our 14th annual poetry nationals, and here in Chicago, actually, is where we're hosting it this year. But it was in Seattle last year, in Minnesota, and this kind of thing.
Right. We should mention that if one reads this book and listens to this CD, you're going to hear all kinds of people all across the map, and all kinds of different styles, although much of this is very high energy and very intense. And we should also mention the fact that the language is not exactly the language of Carl Sandburg, shall we say. How representative is this book and this CD? I mean, did you go out of your way to not sort of sugarcoat this or soft pedal the kind of raw quality that is a part of much of this poetry?
Yeah, very much so. You know, I don't want to use the word urban because automatically that kind of diversifies some things that might not be represented. But we tried to find words that are being used. You know, again, the book is contemporary, meaning alive right now. So there are certain words that people use on a day-to-day basis, which, you know, it's incorporated in everyday life. And that's poetry oftentimes reflects that everyday life. So
one of the excerpts from the CD that I really wanted to play for people is the work entitled Television by a young man named Todd Alcott. I'd like you to say whatever you like as a way of introduction, and then I think we're going to listen to this.
Sure, sure. Todd Alcott is a performance artist out of, he was born here in Crystal Lake, Illinois, but he lives in New York. He actually traveled into New York, into Chicago from New York in the early 90s to participate in the slam stuff. And he wrote the screenplay for Ants.
Mm. And this is sort of his take on the attitude of a television, if a television could actually speak to us who watch it. So here it is, Todd Alcott delivering his poem entitled Television.
Television. Look at me! 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 No, don't look over there! There's nothing to look at over there! Look at me! Look at me! Look at me! Are you looking at me? Is everybody looking at me? Do I have everyone's attention? Don't get the wrong idea. I'm not trying to take over your life. You need what? What do you need? What do you need? You need to what? Go to the bathroom? Fine! Get up! Go to the bathroom! Come back! Look at me! You need what? You need to get something to eat? Fine! Get up! Go to the kitchen! Get something to eat! Come back! Look at me! You need to what? 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 Sleep? Fine! Get up, go to bed, go to sleep, get up, come back, look at me. Okay, so, we have an agreement. You will do what you absolutely have to do, and when you're done, you will come back and look at me. Don't worry about your schedule. I am here for you. I am here for you. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, I am here for you. I am here for you. You need me, I'm here. Fair and foul, thick and thin, I am here for you. I am here for you. People try to tell you I'm bad, you tell them that I am here for you. 24 hours a day, fair and foul, thick and thin, I am here for you. I am here for you. People try to tell you I'm bad. You know what it sounds like to me? sour grapes. You see what I... No, don't look over there. There's nothing to look at over there. Look at me. Look at me. Look at me. I've got stuff you wouldn't believe. Danger, sex, action, death, thrills, comedy, all here, all in the next 8 minutes. Can you believe it? You can't believe it. You can't believe it? It's unbelievable. You can't believe it because it's unbelievable. It's a miracle. Just keep looking at me. Just keep looking at me. Just keep looking at me. Look 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 at me.
That is really quite a work. And I think that also gives us a sense of what you're talking about when you say that a poem can take on an entirely different life for itself when it is lifted off the printed page and delivered in this sort of way.
Yeah, nicely said, yeah. He's actually, he fits in kind of like the monologuist category if we're going to catalog him a little bit. But yeah, Todd's great. If you could picture him, he's a short, I probably should have used this for the setup, he's a short, very pasty white guy with crew-cut black hair, and he's screaming and spitting all over the place as he's doing it. It's extremely entertaining.
Hmm. Some of the items here incorporate sound effects or music, or those kind of things. Do we sometimes find poetry that is not easy to bring off in sort of a live performance situation, poetry or poetry experiences that are brought to life more effectively in the confines of a recording studio? What about that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. A lot of the performance artists, and Todd fits in that, like Sin Salach, she does a lot of sound stuff. So in the book, what I tried to do was follow the history and say that in the early 80s, late 70s, performance art was taking off with people like Laurie Anderson, Eric Bogosian, these sorts of people, and that based on that, Mark Smith saw that poetry didn't have to be this boring thing. So definitely. The cut in the CD called Water Swims Back to Me is actually a poem by Anne Sexton that Sin Salach puts in that framework that you just described with the different horns and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. The thing that's interesting to me is that I think some of us imagine that poets, of course, come in all shapes and sizes, but that maybe once upon a time we might think, you know, rightly or wrongly, we might imagine most poets to be rather quiet, maybe somewhat private souls who pour out their feelings in poetry, and we just can't imagine them up in front of people delivering their poetry in the way that, for instance, Todd Alcott just did.
Sure.
In a sense, if poetry becomes much more of this public performance kind of genre, doesn't it, in a sense, sort of rule out a certain number of poets for whom that is not their gift?
That's actually a good question. And that's kind of something that was misperceived when Slam was first coming out. Slam is one forum. It's a forum that allows people to get up and perform in front of an audience or to read in front of an audience. By no means am I saying that the written poetry is not just as important. And in fact, what I want to say about it is that the veterans of the slam or performance poetry world, and even people like Billy Collins, who tours almost 20 days out of the month now, they read to an audience a very diverse set nowadays. You know, they're conscious. What all this has done is made poets realize, become more conscious of the fact that they have an audience in front of them, whether it's reading off the page or whether it's viewing them, and that there's certain obligations you have to that audience. One of the essays in the book is by Thomas Lux, and he introduces Jack McCarthy and Jeffrey McDaniel. And one of the things he says is, imagine how easy it is to be obscure, to write something that nobody else can decipher, versus the person who writes something to be understood, and to exchange humanity, and to be part of a bigger you. So it's not, you know, I don't want to fight the war that says a page poem is better or worse than a stage poem. I think that the veterans and the better performance poets and the better academic poets realize that they have to diversify when they have an audience in front of them, and they will read some of the funnier stuff. They'll read some of the more passionate stuff. And certainly at slams, you'll find very high scores and a lot of poets that get up there and read stuff that's very much like an Emily Dickinson poem. It doesn't all have to be Todd Alcott, and that's not a shot at Todd Alcott. I think that it's a bigger representation. It's more diverse. Here's some of this, here's some of that, and that whole thing. And that's what poetry slams have always been about. It's never been about one person screaming at you in front of you. It's been about him as well as these other people as well. Hmm. So,
another favorite of mine from the CDs is a poem by Taylor Molly entitled "How to Write a Political Poem."
Yeah, Taylor's another great example. There's a documentary called Slam Nation, which kind of documents the Portland Nationals in 1996, and he's one of the stars of that. He's a very clever writer, and a fantastic performer. And one of the things that you get at these slams, unfortunately, as you get in any art form, is someone sees someone else up on stage, and they tend to copy them.
Mm.
And so Taylor's poem is kind of a satire on people that do a lot of political poems.
Right, and the formulas which people want to follow.
Sure.
Let's listen to it. How to Write a Political Poem by Taylor Molly.
However it starts, it's got to be loud. And then it's got to get a little bit louder. But this is how you write a political poem and how you deliver it with power. Mix current events with platitudes of empowerment. Wrap it up in rhyme, or rhyme it up in rap until it sounds cool. Glare until it sinks in. Because somewhere in Florida, votes are still being counted. I said, somewhere in Florida, votes are still being counted. See, that's your hook. You gotta have a hook. More than the look, it's the hook that's the most important part. Hook's gotta fit. Hook's gotta hit. Hook's gotta hit hard in the heart. Because somewhere in Florida, votes are still being counted. And Dick Cheney is peeing all over himself in spasmodic glee. See what I did? Make fun of politicians. It's easy. Especially with Republicans like Rudolph Giuliani, Colin Powell, and Al Gore. Ooh, see what I did? I called Al Gore a Republican. That must mean that my political sensibilities are much more finely tuned than yours. Talk about idiotic juxtapositions of political personalities and ideologies, as if communism really were the opposite of democracy. As if we needed a Ralph Nader, not a Darth Vader. Amazing grace, how... Stop in the middle of a song that everybody knows and loves. This will give your poem a sense of urgency. Because there is always a sense of urgency in a political poem. There is no time to waste. Corruption doesn't have a curfew. Greed doesn't care what color you are. And the New York City Police Department is filled with police officers who carry guns on their hips and metal badges over their hearts. Remember, injustice isn't injustice. It's just in us, just as injustice is just in ice. Yeah! That is the only alien nation of this alien nation where you either fight for free, dumb, or else you are free but dumb. Here in Freeborn Hall, where you are born free or free born and free. Yeah! And somewhere in Florida, votes are still being counted. And it makes me wanna. Because I have seen devastation of gentrification. And I can talk with great articulation about cosmic constellations and atomic radiation. I saw D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, but I prefer Disney's 102 Dalmatians. And like a cross-examination, I can give you the explanation of why films like Slam Nation are the ultimate manifestation of poetical ejaculation and egotistical manipulation and other things that rhyme like Asian with Haitian and this nation. And maybe it's true that they are still counting votes in Florida, but at the end of a political poem, that just doesn't matter anymore, because all you have to do to end a political poem is get real quiet, close your eyes, and end by saying the same line three times, the same line three times, the same line three times.
is that a good piece?
Yeah, that's really something. Yeah. And, of course, it's really fine, too, in that we are there with him and an audience.
Right.
Now, that's not always the case here, and we've already touched on that fact, that some of this really only seems to fully exist when there is a live audience there to take it in. What is the difference from a performance, for instance, of Taylor Molly and this particular piece? It can't possibly be exactly the same every time.
Right. Well, you'd be amazed at, you know, these rules. Taylor is a good example. I mean, he's making a living touring now as a poet, which is a hard thing to do. know, these people rehearse day in and day out these kind of pieces. So, you know, there's a misnomer out there that a lot of this kind of bleeds into spontaneous while they're up on stage. And it's not a freestyling at all, actually. It's a very rehearsed medium, similar to what you would find in a theater, but not that extreme. But, you know, Taylor, I mean, you can't see it, but he's got eye movements with different words. He's got hand gestures with certain phrases. It's a very rehearsed piece. So, in fact, Russell Simmons of Def Jam, he's doing a theater production on Broadway right now called Def Jam Poetry. And the people that he's using for his Broadway show are from the slam world. And so they, you know, they rehearse just like any professional does.
Hmm. So performance to performance is actually a little more uniform than we might imagine could be possible.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that's, it is very much so, but it still has that, you know, like any live show, it's got that audience and it's got that ability to be something magical between the audience and, and, you know, allows for the poet and the performer to open up in ways that they might not in a studio, that kind of thing.
Right. One of the most extraordinary tracks on the CD is when we are treated to a very young man who apparently is a brilliant talent in terms of poetry. I'm speaking about a young man named Eli Marienthal.
Right.
Tell us about him, and we're going to hear then, I don't think, the entire piece, but just a portion of it.
Sure. He's quite a story. He's 12 years old, and he's on the West Coast in California. Mark Smith did a show for an organization called Youth Speaks. One of the things you have to understand about slam is a lot of it has been directed into the schools nowadays, especially the high schools. Like I said, I'm a high school teacher. We brought out the poet Reggie Gibson, and the kids just love it. You know, it's a language they understand. It forces them to open up their own notebooks, and it's a dialogue that they have, and it's writing. If schools want a cure for literacy, you bring these guys in, and it excites kids. It makes them want to learn to perform, but also, and maybe more importantly, write. And Eli is a great example of that. There's an organization called Youth Speaks that was doing a very special fundraising thing, and they invited Viggo Mortensen, who's also in the book, and he's the star of the movie Lord of the Rings.
Right.
He plays Strider.
Mm-hmm.
So at this fundraiser, Viggo read, Mark read, and then this 12-year-old kid comes out, and he breaks it down. And he does. He's fantastic.
Let's hear just a little bit of that. Again, the poet is named Eli Marienthal. He was 12 years old at the time that he delivered this poem entitled Multiverse.
All right. So a bunch of poets, I guess, take other names. So, I mean, I've been introduced as Eli, but here's my new name. I am the inevitable. I am the inescapable fate of all mortal frames. I live 6 feet under and in the sky. And scurry earth under the shadow of life, and I strike strife with my knife. I am the dance of maggots, forfeiting my identity when I come. God chills in church and wills me not to take the devout, and since he's got some clout, I say cool, G, because I know I'll see them sometime. And my pad covered in lime to prevent rotting, or so they think. Wink, wink. God saves a few, but I spew forth venom, which spreads like wildfire and engulfs. People on their knees scream to God, please, please, not me. It's time they recognize the size of my empire. It's so spectacular, it was admired by Caesar himself. Yo, when I saw him last March. And with the plucking of old, I also plant the new and meticulously place each drop of dew on beds of odorous flowers, their infinite color combination sensations of my domain, summer rain, it's all a part of my existence. My subsistence consists of emotion, commotion, devotion to the never-ending cycle, put it in the rinse cycle, recycle my creativity. Cause I need an endless supply of it, don't deny that you love it. When I say it, I mean life, cut out with my carving knife. It's all my art exposed in my galleria. Yeah, see you down there? You're a multimedia installation. Tickle all sensations with the sights of the ocean, sounds of the birds, the smell of the flowers, the taste of the melting pot, the feel of Pangea, and that's only part of my exhibition. Wait till you see the space mission. The sun is a paper mache ball infused, injected with all the energy, life, and fire you desire at unattainable distances. That's the metaphor, see? And that's only part of my exhibition.
I hate to turn that down. It's quite a lengthy piece, but it is absolutely a brilliant talent, of course, on display. And again, a talent not only for crafting words, putting them together, but then delivering those words in a really electrifying way.
Yeah. There's even, I should mention, there's a youth slam that occurs, and all these different states have, some of the high schools, they have slam teams. So so they have a national championship every year now where the different high school slam teams compete against one another. Hmm. In fact, at the end of this month here in Chicago, actually, we're hosting it again.
Now, how gentle does this kind of poetry ever become?
You know, that too is, you know, when you get to the nationals and there's 300 poets that are competing against it, you know, that's when the evil head of competition kind of comes out, and people oftentimes go to the crowd pleasers and, like Taylor talks about in the political poem, the rhetoric stuff, you know, stuff that they know it's going to get a charge. But that's not always the case. In 1993, I think it was, at nationals again, which is the big deal, you know, you got 2,000 people sitting in an audience watching. One of the people in the book, Lisa Piscani, she said, you know what? She came on stage, she said, let's drop this number stuff. Here's a poem I want to read to you. Hmm. And she read it just as if, you know, like we're talking. And she wanted to de-emphasize the performance and emphasize the words and went really slow. And, you know, that's a great example of someone who had a fresh piece that wanted to give it a try.
Hmm.
It, you know, the unique, you know, if you talk to scholars, the good ones, they all say, you know, what is poetry? And the answer is poetry can be anything. But the problem is then people want to say, you know, I can say it's going to be anything, but what I really mean is this. It has to be in this form, this rhyme scheme, blah, 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 blah. You know, and there's a lot of protection of territory that comes along with that. What slam and what the current academic, the U.S. Poet Laureate, Billy Collins, you know, they're very open in saying this is a very diverse medium. And poetry can be anything. And that's, you know, on stage you get such a diverse amount of talent from everyday people. It could be anything. It could be soft. It could be rhetorical. It could be group pieces. That's something slam's great for. Four people on stage, all working together on a single piece.
Hmm.
So it's really open.
Well, it can be.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess what you're saying is that the gate is open for it to be that diverse, not that always poets step through the gate and explore all of the different possibilities. But
sure.
One,
but that, you know, that's similar to any art form.
Of course,
you know,
of course.
When Picasso's painting, what does everybody want to do? Right.
Yeah, good parallel. I wanted you to mention something that is that we're told about briefly, that among the phenomenon that occur in these competitions and slams is one thing that has to do with filling in the word, anticipating what the rhyme might be. Explain a little more about what that's about.
Sure, sure. The rules, so from slam to slam, the rules change a little different depending upon which venue you're at. The stick that we give in the book, which we call it, or I should say shtick, is the stuff that Mark Smith uses at the Green Mill. And so he's got a list of rules. If you don't like it a little bit, you snap your fingers, which is not beat stuff. Those guys are all dead. If you don't like it a lot, you stamp your feet. If it's god-awful bad, you groan. If it's a male who gets up on stage and is very sexist, you hiss at him. And that used to be for when a man was sexist. Nowadays, it's for anything that a man says on the stage. Laugh, laugh, laugh.
Hmm.
And then the last line of his shtick before the performance is, guess the rhyme. If a poet gets up on stage and you, the audience member, can guess the word after the rhyme, watch the poet's face. It's great fun. So it's kind of that show mentality kind of thing.
Does there tend to be much in the way of improvisation in this arena?
Yeah, that's a real good question, too. When you get more into the hip-hop, which, you know, that's the subtitle of the book, Slam, Hip-Hop, and the Poetry of a New Generation. Some of the slams do have a freestyle element into them, which is when, or it's called ciphering, when kids or when poets get in groups and they kind of freestyle off one another. That's more in line with hip-hop and some of the more urban venues. Not that to say that the slam doesn't have people that get up there and improvise, but for the most case, no, probably like upwards of 90% of the people get up there that have read it a couple of times or have their piece of paper in front of them. Usually.
Right. Well, that's something that also intrigues me very much, that some of these are very finely crafted and carefully choreographed works.
Yeah.
And then some of these others might actually venture into something where you don't know exactly what's going to occur. It also reminds me of a term which actually comes out of those who study the operas of Richard Wagner. One of his guiding principles was something called Gesamtkunstwerk, which was the universal art form, the idea of the visual and the oral all coming together and the whole thing being conceived of as a whole and not just, well, sometimes there's music and sometimes there's dialogue and there's also scenes and there's also ballet and whatever, but trying to get them all to be one whole, one piece. And many of these strike me as being sort of guided by that same sort of principle, trying to blur the lines, the distinction between a piece of paper and the human voice and the actual words. And you know,
that's a beautiful way of saying it, yeah. You know, when I got my MA in philosophy, and one of my instructors told me the worst thing that ever happened in Western civilization is Aristotle creating his categories.
Hmm.
And that Westerners tend to want to break things down and say, you know, this belongs in that, that belongs in this, and that kind of thing. You know, there's a lot on the line for a lot of poets. If someone doesn't read their stuff very well, you know, for them to say that the people that do read it well, that stuff's just as good as mine, you know, that puts you politically in kind of a vulnerable position. You know, the literary world is brutal. You know, to pretend that poets and writers don't compete with one another is just false. You know, these grants that go out, teaching positions, just trying to get a book looked at by different publishing companies. So, you know, there's that element to it. And I agree with you. I think the best readings, the best performances are the ones that incorporate all those different forms. You know, if you know, who's the original poet? You know, Homer, right? That's what we learn in high school even. Can you imagine him standing with a podium and a spotlight underneath him and turning the page to the Iliad as he reads? No, I mean, it's supposed to be a circle. There's supposed to be a fired mentality. You know, you're supposed to have a little maybe glass of brandy or soda, and you're supposed to enjoy the company of the people around you. They're not more than the audience. It's not this exalted artist. It's someone who is part of the audience, too, and wants to reflect things that are going on in everyday lives. Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it.
The book is called The Spoken Word Revolution, Slam, Hip Hop, and the Poetry of a New Generation, and it includes a compact disc with over 70 minutes of poetry read by poets. And our guest today on The Morning Show has been the editor of this volume, Mark Elleveld, The Spoken Word Revolution, published by Sourcebooks Media Fusion out of Naperville, Illinois. Mark Elleveld, a real pleasure to speak with you today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive.
For the next few minutes, we speak about a very intriguing book about a very intriguing place. The book is called Esalen, America and the Religion of No Religion. Esalen was a place created on the coast of California, which became something of a, it's really hard to say. At one point, some place, I don't remember if it's a book or not, was called something like kind of a spiritual think tank. But think tank seems like a very insufficient term to describe the convergence of all kinds of amazing thinkers who gathered it at Esalen in various ways over the years, and particularly during the 1960s and 70s, to share all kinds of ideas and insights into the possibility of spirituality being lived out in ways that had never really been imagined before, at least not in mainstream America. And a history of some of what went on in Esalen is now found in this book, again called Esalen, America and the Religion of No Religion, published by the University of Chicago Press. Its author is Jeffrey Kripal, the J. Newton Razor Professor and Chair of the Department of Religious Studies at Rice University. And I'm glad that we can speak with him for a few minutes about his book. Professor Kripal, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
One thing interests me, and I want to make sure I ask this right off the bat. As we read the book, it strikes me as a very fair and honest history of Esalen and what it has represented over the years, including some of the perhaps great things that have occurred there, and along with some of the things that maybe aren't so great, maybe some of the excesses which have occurred there, the attraction to passing fads or whatever. I mean, it's an honest history. And yet when I read the opening to the book, you write about Esalen as almost as though you are sort of a believer in it. I mean, the introduction to the book makes it sound like you find yourself very much attracted to Esalen and what it stands for. I wonder, first of all, am I reading all of this correctly? I mean, have you tried to write a very honest, fair appraisal and history, and yet at the same time, do you come at it as someone who really very much admires Esalen and what it has represented?
I think that's a very fair reading, actually, of the book. Religious studies is an interesting art. You're constantly moving back and forth between what we call the insider and the outsider perspective, and both are represented in this book. I think the reason that I was attracted to this place and why I wrote the book is that in my own discipline, which is comparative religion, it really comes out of this same time period and is in many ways an echo of the 60s and 70s. And so for me, this book was very much a coming home and a trying to find out more about my discipline's history, but also about my own culture's history. So I think that's fair. I think that's a fair reading of the book.
One of the things you talk about in the book is that it actually it was created by two men who, in a sense, came at it with slightly different visions for what Esalen should be. And just tell us briefly about those two visions.
That's right. The Institute was founded in 1962 by two Stanford graduates, Richard Price and Michael Murphy, who met in about 1960 or so. Dick had come out of, he was a Buddhist meditator and had entered a kind of psychotic break in the mid-50s in the North Beach District area of San Francisco. He was institutionalized for that, and during those treatments he received over 60 electroshock and chemical assaults on his body and mind that he felt were extremely abusive and that shut down the kind of spiritual components that he was also experiencing at the time. So when he emerged from that, he wanted very much a place that was a place of healing and where mind and body could come together in a way that they were being separated in the culture of the time. Michael Murphy, on the other hand, had lost his Christian faith to Darwinian evolution in college, and had then found it again through an Indian philosopher named Sri Aurobindo, who had combined evolution and Indian philosophy. So when Mike founded Esalen with Dick, he was very much after a kind of intellectual ashram or think tank where East and West and science and spirit could come together. The two men, though, worked extremely well together and brought those visions together in a way that turned out to be quite successful.
It is a place in which a dazzling array of thinkers have come. I mean, the long list includes people like Joseph Campbell and Henry Miller and Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac and so many others. So many different things sort of blended together or experimented with, the combination of kind of unlikely things and this and that. What ends up sort of rising to the top out of what might be just a sort of a chaotic mess? certain things, I mean, obviously do emerge and have some staying power and so on.
Right. Well, I think what rises to the top is this central category of the human potential. This notion that consciousness and the body are infinitely deeper and broader and more vast than our science or our religions recognize, and that there are many, many ways to get at that vastness. And so there's a kind of pluralism. It's a kind of pluralistic approach to truth that, we all share the same human nature. and we share that depth and that height, but that it can be expressed in this chaotic way, this infinite number of ways that, you know, some might read as chaos, but others see as richness and as beauty. So I think that's the one of the central messages here, is one of human plurality, but also a shared human nature that is still largely potential in us.
What has the attitude at Esalen been towards what people think of as more standard religious practice?
Right.
I mean, is there a place at Esalen for someone who goes to their local Methodist church on Sunday morning? I mean, are they mutually exclusive?
No, absolutely. I think the majority of people who go to Esalen belong to a traditional religious community of some sort. Not all of them, of course. But I think, you know, I think the general attitude or the general feeling there is again, this religion of no religion that I'm talking about in the book and tracing its history. I think most people would translate that today with the phrase, I am spiritual but not religious. And by that they mean that they may very well belong to a religious community or a tradition, but they recognize that God is not contained or monopolized by their particular church or their particular religion. And so they want to learn as much as they can about other traditions and other religions to develop a fuller view of who God is and who they are. So again, I think it's a kind of rich pluralism that is open to others and to other cultures.
I want to ask you one real quick question, if I may. I know we're just about out of time. You talk in the book about how it can be difficult to use religious language in talking about some of this.
Yeah.
That such language both reveals and conceals at the same time.
That's right.
And that had to be, in a sense, I suppose, quite a challenge. To write this book with that concern on your mind.
That's right. I mean, in some ways, you know, that's what, in some ways, creative writing is all about. It's more akin to poetry than to science or mathematics. You're out to evoke or invoke a certain mood or spiritual sensibility, not to write an equation that will predict everything. So, absolutely, it was very much a work of art for me as well as a work of scholarship.
The book, again, called Esalen, America and the Religion of No Religion, published by the University of Chicago Press, and the author, Professor Jeffrey Kripal. Professor Kripal, I did enjoy this book and the chance to speak with you about it on the morning show. My thanks to you.
Hey, thanks for having me. I do really appreciate it.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Alan M. Brandt's fascinating book, The Cigarette Century, which examines the very significant place of tobacco and cigarettes specifically in American culture and life over the course of so many, many years. Also the author of an intriguing book about white America's assimilation of black culture, a book called Everything But the Burden. On Wednesday, Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor at Carthage College, joins us for his monthly visit to the program. On Thursday, a look at the legend of Daniel Boone with author Tom Clavin. And on Friday, a look at domestic violence and a speaker series that is being started here in southeastern Wisconsin to address this incredibly important issue. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org, and we invite you to subscribe to the Morning Show podcast, which allows you to hear a different morning show 7 days a week. Be sure that you search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for The Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering an online master's degree in healthcare administration. Learn the skills necessary to be a leader and make an impact in the ever-evolving and diverse field of healthcare in partnership with UW Extension. Details are available at uwp.edu. We are approaching 9 o'clock.